administration in particular actually going after the human rights monitors or the legal community that is involved in making these decisions. I'm thinking of Francesca Albanese, of course, but also the judges of the International Criminal Court.
The United States has certainly issued really draconian sanctions on prosecutors and judges, as well as Palestinian human rights organizations, UN special procedures. Those are absolutely having an effect on those organizations. But at the same time, the International Criminal Court is continuing to do its work. It has already issued arrest warrants for Prime Minister Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant for crimes against humanity and war crimes committed in Gaza. There are ongoing investigations and other files. Francesca and the Palestinian human rights organizations have not stopped their work. They're continuing to document abuses. They're continuing to issue reports. They're continuing to be loud and vocal. At the end of the day, Juan, it is the sign of weakness when instead of engaging with facts, instead of defending your positions, when you attack the messenger. And ultimately, those effects can be significant. But we are very lucky to have incredibly strong human rights defenders and mechanisms that are responding to this moment. So it's critical we give them the chance to succeed. And what governments today that are claiming war crimes are being committed, not just Iran, but states in the Gulf, Lebanon, there are steps they can take. It's critical if there's ever going to be justice, if the perpetrators of the crimes that killed the schoolgirls in Iran, that are killing people across the region, if there any hope for justice, there needs to be preservation of evidence today. That means securing sites, securing the weapons remnants. It means engaging with investigators so they can, every single day that passes, the evidence degrades. Ultimately, the path to justice is uncertain, but for it to even have a chance, states need to act. The human rights defenders are ready. What's lacking is political will.
And also, could you comment on the situation that we've been discussing in Lebanon in terms of Israel's once again moving into Lebanese territory?
Absolutely. Look, I mean, we have a clear track record of the Israeli government committing grave war crimes and other abuses in Lebanon, even during the so-called ceasefire over the last year. What we're seeing now with these mass evacuation orders, we saw that same playbook used in Gaza. Human Rights Watch investigated those particular incidents and found that they amounted to war crimes and crimes against humanity, because it is impossible for you to order hundreds of thousands of people to evacuate. There's no safe place for them to go. There's no showing that that sort of mass order is necessary is necessary given what the Israeli government has shown. They have not shown, made a sufficient finding that's warranted. And ultimately, what we see is grave risk for civilians. Remember, there are many people that can evacuate, older people, people with disabilities. And in addition to that, the people that are being evacuated aren't necessarily finding safe places to go, because we've seen the Israeli government strike throughout the country. A ground invasion also portends even further damage. So the situation in Lebanon is extremely worrying, especially when we know the context of what happened after October 7th and even during the ceasefire, where you continued to see Lebanese being killed. Ultimately, the Israeli government, because of impunity, is emboldened across the region. And unless we see a strong response from states that are willing to use the tools of accountability, as well as willing to take action, the risk to civilians across the region will continue to grow and grow day by day.
Omar Shakir, we want to thank you for being with us. New executive director of Dawn, speaking to us from Amman, Jordan, and Leila Younis, investigative journalist and writer based in Beirut. We'll link to your new piece for Dropsite News, Mass Expulsion in Lebanon as Israel Expands War. We don't know where to go. Coming up, President Trump fires Kristi Noem as Secretary of Homeland Security. Thank you so much. We'll be back in a second.
What happened to the words for which we once stood? I will stand for you. Would you stand for me? Everybody deserves to be free. I would lend a hand to you. Would you lend a hand? Be free. It's close.
Everybody deserves to be free by the Resistance Revival Chorus. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn to Washington, D.C. On Thursday, President Trump fired Kristi Noem, the Secretary of Homeland Security. He announced the decision on social media and said Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen of Oklahoma would take over. Noem has been facing intensifying calls to resign or be impeached over disastrous handling of Trump's immigration raids nationwide. She was grilled by lawmakers earlier this week at a series of hearings on Capitol Hill. This is Republican Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina questioning Noem about the shooting deaths of U.S. citizens Renee Good and Alex Preti in Minneapolis.
The fact that you can't admit to a mistake, which looks like under investigation, is going to prove that Ms. Good and Mr. Preti probably should not have been shot in the face and in the back. Law enforcement needs to learn from that. You don't protect them by not looking after the facts. Not only should the FBI be investigating it, but every single law enforcement agency in that jurisdiction should be invited to it. So our law enforcement officers do not have this pall cast upon them.
Noem was also widely accused of corruption. In one instance, she oversaw a self-promotional Department of Homeland Security advertising campaign that cost $220 million. The no-bid contract was awarded to a newly formed limited liability company, which then subcontracted with The Strategy Group, a company whose CEO, Ben Yoho, is married to Noem's former assistant secretary at DHS, Tricia McLaughlin, who just left. This is Republican Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana.
You're testifying that President Trump approved this ahead of time. Is that my understanding?
We had conversations about making sure that we were telling people.
No, ma'am. I'm asking you, sorry to interrupt, but the president approved ahead of time you spending $220 million running TV ads across the country in which you are featured prominently.
Yes, sir. We went through the legal processes, did it correctly.
Did the president know you were going to do this?
Yes.
He did?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
And President Trump said in an interview with Reuters he had not signed off on the spending. While Noem is being removed as DHS secretary, President Trump said she'll stay in the administration in a newly created role, special envoy to the Shield of the Americas, an initiative Trump said would be formally announced this weekend in a summit in Miami. We'll talk more about that later in the broadcast. But first, for more on Noem's ouster and her replacement, we're joined by two guests. Chris Stein is the senior politics reporter for The Guardian U.S. His most recent piece headlined Trump Fires Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. In New York, Justin Elliott, reporter for ProPublica, co-author of several investigative reports on Kristi Noem, including the most recent Kristi Noem Misled Congress About Top Aide's Role in DHS Contracts. Lay out, Justin, if you will, the corruption allegations against Noem. And again, she has not been entirely removed from the Trump administration, just moved to a different role at this point.
Yeah, I mean, the precipitating event that led to her firing was that exchange you played with the Republican Senator Kennedy from Louisiana about this ad campaign. And this ad campaign has been going on actually for, you know, since the very beginning of the Trump administration, as you said. $220 million of taxpayer money for these ads, some of which featured Noem on horseback in front of Mount Rushmore. And, you know, this did not go through the normal competitive process, went to a Delaware LLC that was formed only a few days before before getting this absolutely massive contract. We reported that one of the subcontractors, as you mentioned, was a Republican media firm run by the husband of the former, now former DHS spokesperson, Trisha McLaughlin. You know, it turned out they actually got a relatively small amount of money, but more money went to a couple of other Republican media firms that handled the ad buying for President Trump's campaign. And I will say that, you know, in sort of partial defense of Noam on this, if President Trump or the White House had a problem with this ad campaign, you know, this was no secret. It was announced by press release a year ago. The ads were literally running on Fox and Friends, with which President Trump watches. President Trump is featured in the ads, not just Kristi Noem. They look like sort of campaign style ads promoting both Noem and Trump. So I will say the official story here about the White House being upset about these ads is a little bit peculiar.
And Justin, could you also talk about in the hearings that were held, this the focus also on the role of Corey Lewandowski as a special government employee under Kristi Noem?
Absolutely. So people may remember Lewandowski. He was the Trump campaign manager way back in 2016. He was occupying this, I think, unprecedented role where he was technically a volunteer, not drawing a government salary, but was effectively co-running the department alongside Noem. What that means is that he's actually permitted to have some types of outside income, unlike any other normal government official. So one of the major still unanswered questions is, who is paying Lewandowski? How is he paying the rent? Was he being paid by companies, lobbying firms, at the same time that he was, you know, essentially co-running, you know, one of the most powerful agencies in the government? By the way, we're still reporting on that. Please get in touch with me if anyone out there has information about it. But Noem was asked about this at the hearing, and she denied that he has a role in approving contracts. We reported, based on documents that we obtained, that he was literally signing off on contracts. So that was not a correct description of what his actual role has been at DHS.
Not only signing off on contracts, as you pointed out, but it was in her office firing people. And of course, there was a number of questions by the senators and the Congress members. There were 2 days of hearings about her having an affair with someone who was supposedly reporting to her, though she ultimately said, no, he is reporting to President Trump. I wanted to bring Chris Stein into this conversation, the senior politics reporter for The Guardian U.S. The question is, as you report on Noem's ouster and now the Oklahoma Senator Mark Wayne Mullen being Trump saying that nominating him for this position in the cabinet, isn't she just the face of the immigration policies of the Trump administration crafted by Trump and Stephen Miller? Stephen Miller, the architect of them. Talk about Mark Wayne Mullen and his stance on immigration. I mean, a lot of issues were raised about her calling the U.S. citizens who are killed by immigration agents domestic terrorists before there was any kind of investigation or even evidence of this. I wanted to turn first to Jamie Raskin of Maryland questioning Noem over those statements.
Based on what you know today, Madam Secretary, were Renee Good and Alex Preddy domestic terrorists?
Congressman, what happened in Minnesota in those two incidents was an absolute tragedy.
Were they domestic terrorists, as you said to the country?
My condolences to their families, because I know that their lives will never be the same after that happened.
Is that an apology for what you said?
We, in those instances, offer as much information as we can from officers and agents on the ground in a chaotic scene that gets...
I'll repeat my question, reclaiming my time. Based on what you know today, Madam Secretary, based on what you know today, were Renee Good and Alex Preddy domestic terrorists?
As you know, there's ongoing investigations that are being led by the
FBI. But you didn't wait for the investigation, did you? You didn't wait for the evidence. You proclaimed that they were domestic terrorists at the time.
So, Chris Stein, if you can comment on this interaction, but also what Mark Wayne Mullen brings to this, the senator now nominated to be Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security.
Well, what you just said, you know, regarding how Noem was the face of immigration policy that really came from Stephen Miller at the White House and, of course, it was approved by Donald Trump is exactly what top Democrats said, you know, right after the ouster of Noem was announced and Mark Wayne Mullen was announced as her replacement. You know, they have their own set of demands for the Department of Homeland Security. And they're, you know, they basically said that, you know, no matter who leads it, we're going to continue pursuing these demands. You know, the person that has been chosen, Senator Mullen from Oklahoma, is someone who, when I encounter him at the Capitol, you know, I know he's going to kind of defend the president on the issue of the day. He's not a senator known for opposing, you know, President Trump or getting ahead of him or any, you know, having daylight between him in any way. And when it comes to the issue of immigration, he has been known as a hardliner, you know, has come forward making statements, you know, about ways in which he believes people who are here without documentation can be cracked down on or encouraged to leave, or things that are happening in the immigration system that he thinks needs to be fixed. So he clearly has thoughts on this subject. He's not someone who the president has ever, you know, trouble with. He's often talks to the press. He's out and about saying these things. So in that way, he is, you know, kind of an ideal pick to lead the Department of Homeland Security from the president's perspective.
And Chris, what about Mullen's own previous business activities and potential conflicts of interest as the new Secretary of Homeland Security?
He ran a plumbing business prior to winning election to the House of Representatives in 2012. He was also an MMA fighter. You know, he's been in politics now for about 15 years. You know, I don't think he necessarily has the same sorts of entanglements that we saw with Kristi Noem and Corey Lewandowski. At least we don't know of anything like that yet.
Back in November 2023, during a Senate hearing, Oklahoma Senator Mark Wayne Mullen challenged Teamster Sean O'Brien to a fight, with committee chair Senator Bernie Sanders stepping in to defuse the situation as Mullen got up from his seat to confront O'Brien.
If you want to run your mouth, we can be two consenting adults. We can finish it here.
Okay, that's fine. Perfect.
You want to do it now?
I'd love to do it right now.
Well, stand your butt up then.
You stand your butt up.
Oh, hold on. Oh, hold, stop it.
Is that your all solution, right? Every poll?
No, no, sit down.
No, you're a clown.
Sit down. Okay. You know, you're a United States senator. Sit down.
Act it.
Chris Stein.
When I think about that clip, it was obviously, you know, pretty eyebrow raising at the time, quite a thing to have happen in the middle of a Senate committee hearing. But then the Teamsters went on to, you know, not endorse in the 2024 election, even when in the past they endorsed Democrats. You know, that certainly isn't the reason why Kamala Harris lost. But, you know, you saw Sean O'Brien go and speak at the Republican National Convention, but not the Democratic National Convention. So for all the fireworks there, at the end of the day, they ended up actually helping out Senator Mullen's side much more than they did the Democrats.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Chris Stein, senior politics reporter for The Guardian U.S., and Justin Elliott, reporter for ProPublica. We'll link to both your pieces at democracynow.org. Coming up this weekend, President Trump is going to preside over a gathering of right-wing leaders from across Latin America in Florida as he threatens to target Cuba next. Stay with us.
I'm just an American boy, raised on MTV. I seen all them kids and soda pop ads. None of them look like me. So I started looking around for light out of the dim. First thing I heard that made sense was the word Muhammad, peace be upon him. How should I do?
John Walker's Blues by Steve Earle, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. This weekend, the Trump administration's hosting right-wing leaders from across Latin America and Florida for the, quote, Shield of the Americas Summit to launch a new security initiative for the Western Hemisphere. The heads of state from Argentina, Bolivia, Chile, Costa Rica, the Dominican Republic, Ecuador, El Salvador, Honduras, Panama, Paraguay, Trinidad and Tobago, and possibly others are confirmed to attend. The White House has said the initiative will be to reinforce the so-called Donroe Doctrine, signaling a level of U.S. intervention in Latin America not seen since the Cold War. Speaking on Thursday at the America's Counter-Cartel Conference at U.S. Southern Command, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth urged Latin American countries to take a more aggressive approach against drug cartels, threatening the Trump administration will otherwise be forced to act.
And today, some 200 years later, we still marvel at the wisdom of President Monroe's declaration. We, like you, want borders and sovereign territories that are secure. We want unfettered access to key terrain and trade so that our nations can industrialize. And we want to prevent external powers from threatening our peace and independence in our shared neighborhood. This is the essence of the Monroe Doctrine. No external power will interfere in this hemisphere. Ours should be a region of strong, sovereign nations. It's the same principle that animates President Trump's defense approach today. President Trump and his Department of War are ushering in a new era of homeland and hemispheric defense.
This comes as U.S. Special Forces are now in Ecuador to conduct joint military operations with Ecuadorian commandos to reportedly target suspected drug traffickers. And as President Trump has suggested, regime change in Cuba might be his next target after attacking Iran and Venezuela. For more, we're joined by Jake Johnson, Director of International Research at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, author of the book Aid State, Elite Panic, Disaster Capitalism, and the Battle to Control Haiti. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. Can you explain what this meeting is about and talk about Cuba now in the crosshairs?
Yeah, of course. And thanks for having me. I mean, I think, you know, on its surface, this summit is a show, right? An opportunity for Trump to play out a moment of imperial fantasy in front of fans in South Florida. But I think taking a step back, you know, this does fit very much in line with what has been really in many ways a bipartisan and decades-long strategy of undermining and breaking the left governments in Latin America and consolidating a pro-U.S. right-wing, bloc throughout the hemisphere. And so you see the countries that have sort of appropriately shown their fidelity to the Trump administration and to U.S. policy get invited, and those that don't face the wrath of the Trump administration. We've seen that in Venezuela and Colombia and Mexico and elsewhere, and obviously, as you mentioned, in Cuba.
And Jake, for more than 80 years, the main sort of international body that the United States supported in Latin America was the OAS, the Organization of American States. What does this say, this attempt to create a right-wing, basically, pole in Latin America say about U.S. policy toward the region?
Yes, a really great point, right? I mean, for decades, we've been saying, the OAS is largely controlled by the U.S. It's run by the U.S. The U.S. is, funding more than half of its budget. And that's true. It has largely advanced U.S. interest. And for this administration, even that's not enough, because it is a forum that everyone is invited to, and there are, actual rules, and it's an institution. That obviously doesn't suit this administration's desires, right, which is to really erode those institutions, erode any concepts of sovereignty and international law. And we can see, how this is not just about this hemisphere, right? I mean, you mentioned the Donroe Doctrine, this Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, right? And this is often interpreted as sort of a retrenchment from the rest of the world. I mean, one, we've seen Trump bomb all over the world indiscriminately, and so I don't think that was ever true. But also, looking at historical parallels here, when the United States has sort of focused internally on the Western Hemisphere, that is largely about consolidating control here to then export that globally and extend that globally. And you played in the intro, right, Trump sort of referencing his intervention in Venezuela now with Iran. You can see him doing this. Now, of course, they haven't actually consolidated control in Latin America, but you can see that sort of logic using the hemisphere sphere as sort of a place, as Greg Grannon, a frequent show guest on your show, you know, is called it the Empire's Workshop. So we see how this, you know, the targeting of Cuba, the targeting of Venezuela, the indiscriminate bombing and extrajudicial killings with the drug boats in the Caribbean and the Pacific and all of these things. This is not just about the hemisphere. This is about U.S. power more globally.
And also, could you comment about the countries that are absent from this? Well, clearly, countries like Nicaragua and Cuba and to some degree even Venezuela would be excluded by the U.S., but the three largest countries in population in Latin America, Brazil, Mexico, and Colombia, are also not a part of this effort. How do you feel their governments are dealing, specifically Mexico, with this increased pressure from the Trump administration to lock down and control all of Latin America?
Yeah, I think this is really important, obviously. And we've seen, you know, pushback from Colombia, from Brazil, from Mexico. And I think it is, you know, worth noting that this represents about half of the population in the hemisphere. So we can present this, you know, divided region or, you know, all of these right-wing governments. But there is still this significant block. But, of course, they're under extreme pressure, right? What this administration has shown with the bombing of Caracas, the abduction of Maduro, these extrajudicial killings, right, is that they will go to extreme lengths to punish you if you do not get in line. Mexico, Colombia, and Brazil have all faced that, right? Have all tried to face that and are trying to survive. So I think we do have to understand that. And alone, they are weaker, right? This requires a broader regional and institutional response to check this administration's sort of total erosion of international law. And what we've seen, I think, you know, this effort to gather the right wing is intended to prevent that, right? Is intended to prevent any meaningful opposition to U.S. policy, both in the hemisphere and writ large. And we've seen that, right? So after the abduction of Maduro, CELAC, which is a regional grouping involving all of the countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, but excluding the United States, met to try and come up with a statement. And actually, a majority of countries did agree to a statement, but a small bloc, nine countries, intervened to stop that statement from coming out. There was no official statement. Now, those nine countries are now, almost all of them, invited to Miami to this summit, right? And you can see in the run-up to this, the news of the summit came out about 3 weeks ago, and you've seen this sort of rash of decisions from leaders in the region to sort of show their fidelity to the U.S., so ending cooperation with Cuba, you know, and all sorts of other diplomatic decisions. We saw Honduras and Bolivia actually withdraw from the Hague Group, which was a diplomatic and institutional initiative to try and use international law to end the genocide in Gaza, in which a number of countries in Latin America had been a part of, including Colombia, Brazil, and Mexico, and Honduras and Bolivia under left-wing governments had also been a part of that. They both recently withdrew just in this last week as the Hague Group is meeting with 40 countries to try and come up with an institutional response to this. And so you can see, again, how this is about, you know, using the hemisphere. And I think sort of ironically, right, much of international law and these concepts of sovereignty really came out of Latin American thinking, and the administration now sort of using that same region to undermine them globally.
And finally, Jake, U.S. commandos joining U.S. special forces in Ecuador, joining Ecuadorian commandos in this last 20 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, this is a hyper-militarized and overtly politicized remix of the war on drugs and the war on terror, right? Ecuador has been begging for the U.S. to get involved in that and since Noboa took power. But this is not about drugs. This is not about terror. I mean, the U.S. pardoned Juan Orlando Hernandez, the convicted drug trafficking former president of Honduras, and Noboa in Ecuador, his own family, has been accused of involvement in the drug trade. And so, look, this is about politics. This is about power. This is not about drugs, and this is not about democracy or anything else.
We want to thank you for being with us, Jake Johnston, Director of International Research at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. That does it for our show. I'm headed to Savannah, Georgia, where the award-winning documentary Steal the Story, Please, about 30 Years of Democracy Now! Will be at the Hindsight Film Festival at the Ben Tucker Theater at the Otis Johnson Cultural Arts Center. That's Saturday night at 7 p.m. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
PFLAG Canada is there when it seems no one else is. Are you struggling with an LGBT issue? Every day, PFLAG Canada volunteers are contacted by frightened kids and by angry, fearful, or ashamed parents. PFLAG is Canada's only national organization that helps all Canadians who are struggling with issues of sexual orientation and gender identity. PFLAG Canada supports, educates, and provides resources 24/7. Visit pflagcanada.ca.